from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Thursday marked a milestone for Palestine at the United Nations. For the first time, President Mahmoud Abbas addressed the United Nations General Assembly, representing the state of Palestine, which was granted non-member observer state status in 2012. While Palestine struggles to achieve a peace deal with Israel, we take a closer look at what life is like for the entrepreneurs looking to build Palestine's economy. We'll talk with four Palestinian executives about their work and about how conflict, politics, and policy affect their businesses and their hopes for the future. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. A number of Palestinian businessmen, executives, and entrepreneurs are here in the Bay Area. They're going to be doing a tour of Silicon Valley, and they have a meeting on the 1st of October at Microsoft in Menlo Park to look at and discuss entrepreneurship, innovation, and a sustainable private sector. They join us for this hour of Forum in studio. We want to welcome them, and let me tell you who is here with us. I want to welcome, first of all, Nafez Hussani, who is Vice President of ICT and Digital Business of the Greek-based Consolidated Contractors Company. It's the largest construction company in the Middle East. He's a founding partner and founding member, I should say, of the Palestine Education Initiative. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Morning.
We also say good morning to Amar Akur, who is a CEO and a member of the board of directors of the Palestine Telecom Group, or PALTEL for short. He is a member of the board of the Palestine Development and Investment Company, PEDICO Holding. And during his tenure, four PATEL female employees were ranked among the top 50 women executives in telecom. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
By the way, I should say our guests will be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club on Market Street at 6 p.m., but they're all here with us this hour. And we also welcome Sabri Sidem, who is advisor to the Palestinian president on telecommunications, information technology, and technical education organization. He introduced the second mobile phone operator in Palestine and founded the Palestine Digital Library back in 2004. Welcome to the program. Let me also welcome, as our guest here this morning, Zahi Houri, who is founder and chairman and CEO of the Palestine National Beverage Company. He's also chairman of a number of boards, including the Jerusalem Development and Investment Company and the Palestine Tourism and Investment Company. And welcome to you. Good morning. Glad to have all you gentlemen here. And let me begin, if I may, let's begin actually by talking with Nafez Hussani. You were just a number of you, I guess, were with Secretary Kerry last week in a meeting. And what went on?
Actually, Zahi is the guy who was with Secretary Kerry, and I'll let him have this one. And
all right, I'll come back to you. That's fine.
Thank you.
Well, what went on were a lot of goodwill gestures, an explanation of his economic initiative, the three-year economic initiative, which they call aspirational, and it's managed by the quartet, as you know, headed by former Prime Minister Tony Blair. But I felt for the first time, and which could be an oxymoron, but from a politician who's been extremely sincere, you know, about what he said. It came from the heart, and also very much what he said, he was focusing what should for every American politician be looking at U.S. national interest in the first place, or not some foreign country's national interest. And he spoke very candidly about the three tracks he is working on, political, security, and economic track. But at that evening, the focus was really on the economic track. And he outlined his program with focus on eight sectors of the Palestinian economy. And the plan is to invest. And I must say, by the way, it's not a taxpayer's economic initiative paid by the U.S. taxpayers.
Very important point to make.
it's very much a private sector economic initiative. The investment will be sourced from the private sector. American from the Arabian Gulf countries, Japan, European Union, and so on. And the program has some key objective, which is, by the way, to increase the level of employment and bring down the level of unemployment to 8%. Today, we're around 24%. And to create some economic activities in those various sectors, tourism, agriculture, construction, ICT, and so on. I mean, these are the key sectors which the secretary is focusing on. And at this point, we don't know more than what we've been told, but in general, I think the Palestinian private sector is trying to see how it can help and to what extent it will support it, because we shouldn't confuse a political track and I mean, this is really the should be the front runner and not the economy. I mean, without a political settlement, it's going to be very, very difficult to see a booming economy as this is being planned.
Well, we've heard and read little about what's been going on. So at this, thank you for that briefing, because at this point, a lot is mysterious. Let me actually bring Amir Akar into this, because he's been very concerned about, and I should say for the sake of listeners, the West Bank is divided into three areas, is briefly or generally called A, B, and C. And C accounts for 65% of the West Bank and is pretty much fully controlled by Israeli authorities. We were talking a little bit about spectrum before we came in, and I know this is of concern to you. A lot would depend on what is done in C in terms of opening things up, would it not, politically?
That's true. The spectrum is a big issue in the West Bank and Gaza and all Palestinian areas. We have two mobile operators, two cell phone operators, and the spectrum cannot be released to them unless the Israeli authorities approve the release of a spectrum. We're still working on very old technology, 2G. We could not introduce the third generation and fourth generation technology, so mobile broadband is very limited, simply because the Israelis have not released the frequency to the Palestinian operators yet. Although
you need Israeli approval to expand networks.
Yes, we do. We cannot operate without the release of frequencies, because also we import all the new technologies and all equipment, servers, switches, everything, we import it through the Israeli port. And if they don't approve it, we cannot really get the equipment in. You mentioned something about Area A, B, and C. We still have major difficulties in covering Area C, simply because under the full, it's under the full control of the Israeli authorities. And we cannot place antennas or towers in those areas, and our customer gets disconnected sometimes when he or she travels through those areas, simply because the settlements are there and the Israeli authorities don't allow us to build antennas next to settlements, which cause some difficulties in giving good service to our customers in Area C specifically.
We should also mention that under the Oslo Accords, I believe this is at this point illegal. I mean, there's that the Palestinian are supposed to be operating on Palestinian land. You're losing literally millions of dollars.
Yes.
Let me bring Nafis Husseini into this conversation. In fact, I think, as I understand it, Mr. Husseini, there is a provision in the Oslo Accords that actually allows for communications. I mean, specifically addressing communications, Palestinian autonomy in communications.
Absolutely. But, you know, this was all tied to Israeli approvals. So while there are allowances there, they haven't been given. And this doesn't apply only to telecommunications. It applies to many other aspects. For example, building permits. We have 60% of the land and we are not really able to build on it, thereby limiting our population expansion and also planting that area. So it is a very grave dilemma, and we believe that the Oslo Accords are outdated, and we need to get this new initiative going.
And Sabri Sidim, you said that working in IT felt like carving in stone.
Indeed,
I think that's
right.
That's a direct quote, isn't it? I mean, you've got, half of the households in the West Bank, the largest number of Facebook users per capita anywhere are in Gaza, and the largest number of video conferencing. I mean, this is pretty wide consumer.
Indeed, absolutely right. And sometimes one feels that in any sector in Palestine, working under occupation is more like carving in stone. But despite that fact, we have an literacy rate that stands at 95%. 76% of the population is under the age of 34. 70% of the youth have computers, and 82% are connected to the internet, which means that we are a vibrant society. Yes, connected under harsh circumstances, would like to have 3G and 4G. But despite that, we are anxious to be connected, to be online, to tell the world the Palestinian story, and to push ahead with the development projects that can advance the Palestinian scene at large and bring about some sanity into a region that's hardly hit by poverty and conflict. So indeed, we're carving in stones, but we're making progress.
There was also a storming of the borders on Naqadah back this month, earlier this month, and one can assume, though you may not have any Walgonim like they did in Egypt, that all this wide usage is going to make a big political difference in terms of the grassroots.
Absolutely, and people have been advocating the start of the so-called Third Intifada. Maybe it's happening indeed in social media. People are vocal. They talk about their feelings and aspirations. They talk about their dreams. And since the population of Facebook maybe now makes up the third ranking size in terms of those activists using Facebook, in terms of population, in terms of activity that takes place. And indeed, Palestinians are not the children of a lesser God. They are involved. They deliver their voices, and they want to be heard. They're saying enough is enough with occupation, enough is enough with settlement, and it's about time that UN resolutions are upheld and deployed and implemented, and that the U.S. exercises its authority of bringing some sense into the region that's, as I said, was hard hit by poverty and conflict. So, yes, things are moving in the right direction, and maybe the youth of Palestine, the numbers that I mentioned, will make a difference.
Amir Akir, as I understand it, you can't even place antennae near the settlements at this point, and that makes it even more of a politically charged, as well as economically charged, situation for you. I'm just wondering, in fact, you get a lot of multiple disconnections with this 2G technology that you have.
Yes, we do. And, you know, this issue about antennas in AOC, it's very dramatic, and it affects our business. And we have to go with workout solutions to solve it and minimize the disconnection with the service. One more challenge that we're facing in our telecom business is that we had to place our switches outside the country. The switch in the mobile network, it's like the hard disk for the computer. And the Israeli authorities has forced us to place our switches in London and in Jordan, you know, and we are the only operator in the world with the customers sitting on one continent and the infrastructure sitting on different continent. But we're still providing the service, we're still operating in a difficult environment, and we're still a profitable company making good returns to our shareholders.
And Mr. Hosseini, there are, you've been involved in, the world's largest, I believe it's the largest mall in Dubai, and also a number of other major malls throughout the Middle East. So there's a lot of working economically with the Emirates now. There's a lot of working, I guess you've done work, haven't you? You've built in Egypt and Libya. Arab states are working together with Palestinians, and there's a lot of cooperation. Actually, I'm talking again to Mr. Hosseini over here.
Yes, Michael. We have a lot of construction going on, and in fact, the Palestinians have a reputation in the Gulf for being the exiled people that built the Gulf, believe it or not, because when we were displaced out of our homelands, we went and worked in those countries, and because we couldn't get access to our own country, we built them like our own, so we have a very good reputation in construction in the Gulf. And basically, this is good and bad. I'll tell you, we have a lot of good business and good jobs there in the Gulf for Palestinians, but at the same time, there's a brain drain that is happening in the homeland. Kids don't have enough economic opportunities in Palestine, so you find them that they have to move out and work in Dubai or in Qatar or move on to Europe or move on to the States. So what we hope for is to be able to expand our business into areas like Area C, which is now, as you know, restricted to construction, and thereby create major amounts of jobs that are gainful and that can really help in peace initiatives as well.
Well, if this peace initiative moves forward, Mr. Reeve, let me go to you on this. Where does Hamas figure in this? In fact, I've seen a lot of building going on in Hamas, a lot of economic advancement there too, in the West Bank.
Well, the construction industry per se, I don't consider it to be the most sustainable thing. I mean, what I'd like to see is some more productive industries. Our growth rate, when you look at the numbers, you see that we have a growth rate. At some point, we reached double digits, thanks a lot to the donors, countries. But also, you look at the industrial sector, you see a double-digit negative growth, you know, which means that we haven't had any investments, we haven't had any job creation. And this is why we're looking at this Kerry initiative, because the idea is to create almost 300,000 jobs, which is quite a lot over a period of 3 years. You asked me about what's going on in Gaza. Gaza, well, is an integral part of the state of Palestine, as it's been recently recognized, and there's a lot of activity going in there because also some donor money comes in there, and they had to work under duress, being a blockade. They have very little outlets. Now things are moving in the right direction. Cement and steel and so on is being allowed to get into Gaza. And we're seeing some growth there. But generally speaking, I think what we are seeing with Secretary Kerry, if he moves, and I say it's a big if, makes great progress with the peace process, and I have no doubt, probably when it comes to the peace process, we haven't seen a more aggressive Secretary of State in the last 2 decades, you know. And I think he's it's a big personal mission he has, and I very much hope he'll get the Peace Nobel Prize at the end of that, you know. Should we get to our objective?
I'm sure he would be very happy to be the recipient. Is there really some, you read about cooperation with the Israelis in the occupied area in terms of business and economics. There is a good deal of that, isn't there?
Well, cooperation, I mean the Palestinian territory is a captive market for the Israelis. I mean, it's like a one-way trade. Although we have legally... we have what we call the Paris Protocol, which is kind of a sub-agreement of the Oslo Agreement. Things are not moving accordingly because the Paris Protocol also allowed for spectrum, allowed for frictionless trade, etc. But that's not the case right now. Israel has a trade surplus of approximately $4 billion. in their favor when it comes to trade with the Palestinian territory. And
providing a lot of jobs, though, nonetheless, yes?
Well, it's providing a lot of jobs for the Israelis, yes.
Not for the Palestinians?
Well, you can say indirectly for the Palestinians, but to a very, very limited extent, because it's mainly consumer products and some hardware. But it has also a big negative in a sense that we're not also in control of our income from customs and VAT taxes, etc. So really, we hope that this will change. There aren't any joint venture to say between Israelis and Palestinians, but there is the trade is there. But there is a lot of dialogue going on between the private sector in Palestine and the Israeli private sector without any economic interests, but to promote peace, you know. And that is extremely important that this is at least happening. And we call it breaking the impasse. And we hope to break that impasse between the two political leaders or between the two political systems.
Well, one can hope, although I was reading, I guess, Mr. Seidem, you were talking about your son seeing an Israeli on television, and he was not in a military uniform, so your son couldn't determine that he was an Israeli?
Michael, let me admire your research skills because you've been reading me well over search engines on the internet. Indeed, yeah, that's the perception of a Palestinian child. Yeah. The only interaction with Israelis comes through checkpoints. This is not the ideal situation, obviously. And if you're soliciting peace and advocating peace, this formula ought to be changed. And that's why we're here. We're bringing hope to America. We want America to bring hope into Palestine. And we're advocating a change of the situation by pushing development in Palestine, by putting emphasis on ICT, on construction, on tourism, agriculture, and see that the land of Jesus Christ, as one of our fellow Christian fathers had said, that it's the best export of Palestine, Christianity, and Jesus Christ.
Well, thank you also for the compliment, but it prompts me also to bring up the fact that you've been very involved, I believe, in promoting entrepreneurship and innovation among young people. And let me talk about what the main challenges are there.
Absolutely, and I bring those into the studio to talk about their aspirations, and they all have common problems. They say occupation, development under occupation, it's hard. We have to push for the end of occupation and for harmony and peace and tranquility to exist in the Middle East. Moreover, they talk about their hardship, economic hardship, whereby they need the funding to continue their education, they need the funding to start their businesses, they need the mentoring throughout so they are ready for the market. And they talk about the business environment in Palestine that's so captivated by Israeli measures, needs better banking system, better loans, and we need policies and decisions at the government level so the entrepreneurship spirit is promoted and pushed forward. So indeed, yes, that's my baby. I enjoy working with youth and I enjoy promoting innovation, and I would like to invite you on air now to the celebration of innovation due to take place on the 24th of November, and promise me to come so that you will see firsthand the spirit of the Palestinians at large.
Well, Mr. Ouri, in my research, I also read a piece that you wrote for the Huffington Post about the resignation of the Prime Minister, Fayyad, and essentially you said there's a crisis in Palestinian leadership, that crisis is based on the fact that the international community in Israel have not provided the support for leadership. What about within Palestine? No blame at all? No responsibility?
No, but I mean, there is obviously a responsibility because...
Wait, hold that thought because we're coming up on a break here and I want to involve our listeners in this and give you an opportunity to join us in this program. In fact, let me do that now because we are coming up on a break and the break stops for nobody. We're talking about growing businesses in Palestine among the conflict and uncertainty with four leading figures in the entrepreneurial and executive community. Our toll-free number, should you care to join us, is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your phone calls, any questions or comments you might have. Join us now at 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. But again, feel free to join the program. And again, Thursday marked a milestone for Palestine at the United Nations. For the first time, President Mahmoud Abbas addressed the United Nations General Assembly representing the state of Palestine, which was granted non-member observer state status in 2012. While they're struggling for peace with Israel and Israel with them, we're talking about economics when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about growing business and entrepreneurship in Palestine amid the conflict and the uncertainty there with four leading executives who are here doing a tour of Silicon Valley, and they're going to be at Microsoft. They are all Palestinian businessmen. And by the way, an invitation was kindly extended to me by Mr. Seidem. I didn't mean to shuck it off. I don't know what I'm going to be doing in November, but thank you for that. The Global Entrepreneurship Initiative is what he was alluding to, which will be a whole week in Ramallah. And I suspect that that invitation is not only to me, but to Americans who might want to also participate.
Absolutely. We look forward to their participation, especially the culmination on the 24th of November, which will see the celebration of innovation and three major events to basically mark Palestinian innovation. So again, hope is on the table. We'd like to see that hope being picked up by Americans who will participate and endeavor to support such hope.
And again, we invite your involvement in this program. You can go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or email us forum@kqed.org. And when we went to the break, I was speaking with Mr. Khoury about an article that he published in the Huffington Post about the lack of leadership in Palestine. And pretty much you put the blame on Israel and on the international community. So I asked you, where does Palestinian responsibility come in?
Well, I mean, it's not a question of blame, but what is the issue was raised that that we have only one capable leader among almost 4 million Palestinians, and the world got nervous when Dr. Salam Fayyad, the former prime minister, resigned. And the message what I was trying to get across that, you know, we do have many young leaders and so on. And unfortunately, we haven't had, yes, you can blame Israel, you can blame the international community for the lack of taking on their responsibility, you know, for what's happening in Palestine. With no elections and almost a bankrupt system, financially bankrupt Palestinian government, it has become very, very difficult to generate also new leadership.
But the United Nations is giving you state status now. I mean, that's quite a jump, despite Israeli opposition and American opposition.
It's great to have it, but it's the only state I know of which is under occupation. And, you know, with the occupation going on, when you have, when your president of a state can be turned back from the borders by a teenager, you know, in Israeli uniform. I wouldn't call that really a full-fledged state, you know.
Would you be more hopeful, and I'll address this to any of you gentlemen, would you be more hopeful under different leadership across the border in Israel than presently under Bibi Netanyahu?
Well, that's the Israeli people who have to decide who the leader is. But if you ask me that, if I were an Israeli citizen, I wouldn't be terribly happy considering that he hasn't been able to deliver peace, you know, to his people, to his own people. So that's...
Of course, they would counter by saying Abu Mazen has not been able to deliver peace, right? I mean, the Israelis would use that argument.
Well,
Netanyahu would use that argument.
Let's put things in context. Abu Mazen is the occupied. He's not the occupier. And the asymmetry is very clear there.
Let's go to our callers and find out what they have to ask or say. Dave, you're first up. Good morning.
Hi, are you? Is this for Dave in Castro Valley?
If you're Dave in Castro Valley, you're on the air.
Okay. Yes, thank you very much for this program. It's so great to be able to hear the Palestinian side of things, especially, you know, where there's so much other stuff going on in the media with the Israeli voice. I wanted to ask about your guest today, if there is any signs in Silicon Valley of some specific economic projects that Silicon Valley companies might be interested in Palestine.
I think they're pointing at you, Mr. Saidim.
Yeah, indeed. We get a lot of good vibes from Silicon Valley. That's why we're meeting at Microsoft. We have a meeting aligned at Google, and we're going to Stanford, as you advertise also tonight, Commonwealth. There's a series of meetings. Yes, there's projects to focus on mobile phone applications, maybe the Arabization of internet web content, and focus on telecom program development and areas of different aspects, which we hope that will be responded to positively.
You're looking for partnerships and investments.
Absolutely. Yeah. Investments in Palestine, partnerships and exchange of expertise, and also mentorship of Palestinian entrepreneurs. Yes.
Mr. Husseini.
I'd like to say also that really the main pitch in our trip here is to tell Silicon Valley that we have a great talent pool, and if they'd like to swim, please jump in. We'd like to do business with you together. And really, we can do good business together.
Let me bring another caller on. And Nicholas, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. First, I'd just like to say that these gentlemen are actually great representatives from the Palestinian state. I'm thoroughly impressed with where they're going with relation to speaking on business. I've always believed economic prosperity can bring peace anywhere. But that said, one of the things that you guys mentioned was also on tourism, And as a Westerner, I'll be honest, you know, the information sometimes can lax. But I am curious, one of the things that always stuck out with me, and I don't remember specifically where it was, but with relating to people coming and spending time in another country, I think they were kissing on the beach and got arrested. And I just wondered, how do you guys view that situation? And how, let's say, if Western tourists are coming in, what should they be aware of? And anyway, I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the question. Who would like to? They're looking at you, Mr. Khoury.
Yes. Well,
the expert on beach kissing, or
well, the only beach we have is Gaza, and we were hoping to make it the Riviera of the Eastern Mediterranean at some point. But it's an excellent question, because tourism would like to say should or ought to be our oil well, you know, because we have a very unique situation considering the holy sites, and we have over 10,000 cultural sites. We have the birthplace of Jesus, and also the place where Jesus was crucified. And we have many other. We have the oldest city, still living city in the world, 10,000 years old. The city of Jericho.
One of the questions for potential tourists would be, though, how safe is Palestine?
Well, I can tell you, since I have lived and I live partly still in the United States, it's safer than many major cities in the United States. We haven't had a single accident, as far as I can remember, the last 20 years with any foreign tourists. I think it's safe there. The only problem we're having with the tourism is that we don't have that free access for a lot of our brothers and sisters, whether they are Muslims or Christian, to come and visit. I mean, and this is, by the way, one of the major enabler which Secretary Kerry is focusing on, is the access to the Holy Land. You know, sometimes, I mean, they're opening it now. He's striving to get the Allenby Bridge, the crossing from Jordan to Palestine, to open it 24 hours. But we don't want 24 hours of humiliation. We wanted 24 hours of free access, quick access, because at some point we get foreign visitors who could spend up to 4 or 5 hours at the crossing, checking their security background, etc. Overall, if you look at the revenue numbers in terms of tourism, what Palestinian tourism sector revenue of the total Holy Land revenue is 5%, no more than that. It should be really, if we take the conditions there, it should be at least 1/3, you know. And there are plans, and the Kerry program is to create 5 major hubs, and the proposed investment over the next 3 years is approximately $900 million, which will go into infrastructure and more hotel rooms, and maybe more activity with private-public sector partnerships and so on.
And let me remind listeners that we're speaking now with Zahi Khoury, who is founder and chair and CEO of the Palestinian National Beverage Company. And we also have Amara Carr with us, who is CEO and a member of the board of directors of Palestine Telecom Group. Nafis Husseini, vice president of ICT and digital business of the Greece-based Consolidated Contractors Company, which is the largest construction company in the Middle East. And Sabri Sadim, who is advisor to the Palestinian president on telecommunications, information technology, and technical education. Let me bring on another caller, and that's Lisa from Oakland. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. From what I understand from the guests is that the biggest challenge to economic development in the region is the relationship with Israel. And from what I understand, that it's the acknowledgement of Israel's right to exist that's the linchpin of those peace discussions. And the, you know, access and things that would help economic development, at least based on what the guests are saying. So my question is, do the guests take the position that Israel has the right to exist?
Yes, we go first, Amara Carr.
Well, I guess the Palestinian leadership has acknowledged the right of Israel to exist since 1988, and the Oslo Agreement was based on this recognition. So this is our position. This is the position of the Palestinian leadership. We need
of the Palestinian Authority, but not of Hamas. We should distinguish, yes?
Well, the PLO is the legitimate and official representative of the Palestinian people. They signed an agreement with the Israeli authorities, with Israel, and they signed an agreement with the Israeli leadership. And all what we're asking for is a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders, which basically says that we acknowledge the right of Israel in the rest, on the rest of the historic Palestine before 1948. So the question of acknowledging the right of Israel to exist is far behind us. And sometimes I'm not sure why the Israeli leadership will bring this question, because it's in writing. The acknowledgement is in writing based on the official political agreement.
I suspect it comes up because of Hamas. But Sabri Saidim, yes.
Yeah, let me say that we need to move away from dwelling on old stories that have become totally bankrupt and outdated. The issue of the existence of Israel has long been endorsed by the Palestinian Authority. The two-state solution is the basis of the negotiations. The 1967 borders whereby a Palestinian state is to be incepted is already taken for granted by the international community. What we ask is for Israeli recognition of these terms, that yes, there are 60-plus UN resolutions ought to be implemented, and that a Palestinian state ought to come into being. So enough is enough on dwelling of stories of the past. Let's look to the future. We're here advocating hope, and let's pick up on hope and the message of peace that we're bringing to Silicon Valley and bringing to America.
Let me read an email from a listener named Wasim, who writes, can you please ask your guests about the effects of the extremely corrupt government officials and heads of public and large private companies on entrepreneurship in Palestine? That corruption dates back to the days of Yasser Arafat. Mr. Houri?
Well, I've been this issue, I've been involved since 1992 when we formed PEDICO, which is the largest at that time and continues to be the largest holding company, which has telecom, industrial estate, tourism, etc. I can assure Mr. Wasim that we haven't been asked by anybody to give him a 15% carried interest, you know, in the companies. I've been reading this in the Western media, which I find it quite amazing, for people overseas know about our corruption where we're living there on a day-to-day basis. We
so
don't
no one
see
has,
that.
As we say in the West, leaned on you or tried to extort money
not
from
at,
you. Or
not at all. But I can tell you, I think equally bad is the issue of mismanagement. I don't think we've had the best managers in terms of the public sector. That, as a businessman, I would criticize openly on the air and also in presence of our leadership. But I also bring suggestions to them. But this is blown totally out of proportion. I mean, there isn't much to take away. I mean, we have a GNP of around 7 billion. When we signed, it was around probably 3 billion. And there are a lot of fairy tales, really, about the corruption. And when I see what's happening in the neighboring countries, I don't read much about the corruption.
We did read about, posthumously, Yasser Arafat having a great deal of money stacked away, and a lot of that money was assumed to be perhaps not necessarily from extorting businesses, but from money that had gone into aid for the Palestinians. At least that was the assumption in the Western press.
But after his death, till now, that money would have appeared. Mr. Arafat, I've known him personally, and I don't think there is any leader in the world who has lived more modestly than he has. And
certainly
and we definitely haven't seen any of the money, and if it existed, it would have appeared.
The widow is supposed to have, at least this is according to Western accounts, the widow who lives in
Paris. She's still living on a monthly salary from the Palestinian Authority.
Well, you know, when you come on to talk about entrepreneurship, you get questions from all over. And this is another example. Another listener says, how do the Palestinians deal with the evangelical Christians who predict the rapture begins when Israel is in war and they support Israel in all things? How do Palestinians deal with the political meddling in the USA on behalf of Israel for oddly Christian religious reasons?
Can I just say that when I at the outset of this interview, I'd said that the biggest export of Palestine has been Jesus Christ, and that Christianity is what we're proud of. I'm a Muslim myself, and I celebrate Christianity as much as I celebrate Islam and Judaism in the land of the three religions. What we need to get is that we can dwell on miseries all our life and get nowhere. What we're saying today is that if there is hope, let's work hand in hand to bring about this prosperity that the Palestinians need so desperately. But rather to divide the Palestinians by saying, you know, this one is Christian, the other one is Muslim, or indicate or imply that their treatment of Christians is not proper or what have you. I live there. I lived in Gaza. I lived in the West Bank. I studied in the West. I'm so proud of my ethics, and I'm so proud of my people, whom, despite endless years of occupation, have held their hands together, have worked united, and have not been in any way exercising any prejudice against Muslims or Christians or even Jews. I know this may sound as something odd to some listeners who have seen years of conflict.
Well, they also indeed, read about what's going on indeed. In Egypt against Coptic Christians. I mean, you know, that's right across the border, really.
Sadly, this is the byproduct of the Arab Spring and the unrest that exists everywhere in the world. Whenever you have minorities, wherever you have majorities, there's problems that are incurred, but these problems should not deter the major message. We are here to say end occupation, bring prosperity, and let's work towards the development of the region. We are not saying let's kill Israel, rather saying bring birth to Palestine. We are not saying that we would like to see the end of Israel, but rather the birth of the very Palestinian state that has long been overdue. So enough on dwelling on problems. Let's face reality. We are the leaders of tomorrow, and we need to make that happen and translate this into actual steps to be taken.
And we'll go to more of our callers. Christine, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I am curious. Are you focusing at all on alternative energy? And I'll take my replies offline.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Akar.
On renewable energy?
Well, renewables or alternative energies, yeah.
Well, this sector has a major part in the economic development plan that Mr. Kerry is proposing, and the private sector also is working heavily on the renewable energy, and it will have a major role in the Palestinian economy. We have plans, and hopefully we'll be able to implement those plans in the near future if we get the proper mechanism to get those alternative energy resources. It's important to...
Is it going to come up in Silicon Valley when you're there? Anything specific to alternative energy?
There's been a lot of talk about alternative energy. We have 311 days of sunshine in Palestine. Solar energy is big. Wind energy is another aspect, but as you know, geography is being captivated by Israel. We don't have enough spaces to install the turbines. But indeed, solar energy is one hot thing, and we're working with the Americans, with the Canadians, hopefully with the Germans, to bring about some renewable energy solutions. We have now a test power plant installed by the Japanese in Jericho, the oldest city, so to generate electricity, since it is in scarcity and it's very expensive in Palestine.
The power plant is not... I take it a nuclear plant, like...
No.
Okay. When you said Japanese, I'm sorry, that was my...
Would be happy.
No, it's a solar panel.
I'd like to add that you'll find that many of the private sector companies have adopted sustainability as a core value. And within sustainability, you have renewable energy and the use of renewable energy as a major thing. So definitely you'll see the renewable energy as a hot topic that will be expanded on tremendously in the coming years.
And actually, we start using it in our antennas to generate electricity in some certain areas in the West Bank. You know, it's one of the early stages experiences that we have put in Northern West Bank.
I had a caller who has done business in Palestine. Susan, welcome.
Hi. First of all, I wanted to say thank you for doing this show. I'm very pleased that finally Palestine is getting some positive press. A couple things. One, traveling to Palestine, I was there for a month a couple years ago, and it's very safe, and I was a single woman traveling around on public transportation and felt perfectly fine. And one thing that really struck me while I was just walking through downtown Ramallah was how everybody said, oh, you're an American, welcome. It was the most common phrase that I heard anywhere was welcome. Jericho is beautiful. So if anybody does get to go to Palestine, I really hope they do, because it's a beautiful place and the people are absolutely wonderfully welcoming. I also wanted to mention that the in the ICT sector, there's a lot of really brilliant people that do, and there's some great universities at Palestine. I'm not sure if that was mentioned, but they, the university in Nablus and Al-Quds, there are some really great universities that are covering computer science, computer architecture, Bethlehem University. So there are some great universities that are producing some wonderful graduates that are very, very smart and very capable. And when I was doing business there, I was working with three companies that are doing mobile apps and outsourcing to companies for software development, and working with Cisco and other companies. So there's a lot of very good experience and expertise in Palestine. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Susan, thank you for the comment. Mr. Husseini had a response.
Susan, thank you for your genuine testimony about the security and safety of tourism. And I'd like to invite you to a falafel sandwich the next time you're in Ramallah. It'll be on me.
And the invitation is open also to November's
Michael Gross
invitation. Thank you. Thank you. So and Bob writes, there was a recent Forbes magazine piece that described technology business development, where Palestinian entrepreneurs and investors work with Israeli companies as well as U.S. companies to further technology development work. There was some pushback to the article from those Palestinians featured in the article due to the fear of them being viewed as collaborators. What are your guests' view on this issue?
Well, it's important to take into consideration the fact that
yes,
indeed, important to take into consideration the fact that we should not put the cart before the horse, as they say. We have to show some steps on the political ground so that there is political progress that induces economic cooperation and economic development. Indeed, the Forbes piece was so hopeful. It was reflecting a piece of cooperation and really showing as if there was no conflict. And that's why it has generated a lot of anxiety and has generated a lot of criticism for the fact that it had shown an atmosphere of total cooperation, which is not the case, really. If there's been some success stories here and there of cooperation, should not be portrayed as if the entire scene is rosy. The situation continues to be loom and gloom. It continues to be mistful and continues to be questionable vis-a-vis political development.
But is there pressure on those who work with the Israelis? That was really the tenor of the question.
Absolutely. And consider the fact that the Prime Minister of Israel, who has not made any progress yet vis-a-vis peace, has been advocating his very own recipe of what he calls economic peace. So that article played into the tune of economic peace and was not welcomed by the Palestinians, because cooperation would mean that things are normal and that we are buddies and that we're enjoying this connection. Indeed, we will be enjoying this connection should there be progress on the political scene. And that's our message to Foreign Secretary Kerry, that indeed, should there be any economic cooperation, any economic development, it has to be preceded by a catalyst. That catalyst is political progress.
Well, there's another catalyst. John writes an email and says, Secretary of State Kerry seems to be committed to put this longstanding conflict to an end. He also talked about a private sector economic initiative of over $4 billion over 3 years. How realistic is that, this listener wants to know? I mean, that's a big figure.
Well, there's no question. It is a very ambitious plan. And I think if we would see some relaxation of these various obstacles we have, I mean, there is one page, by the way, in his 150-page plan, which is very interesting. It says the enablers. And if these enablers don't happen, or part thereof, we're not going to make any progress, because you can't talk about frankly, $4 billion when, I mean, a CEO of a multinational asked me over the phone when he read about it. He said, do you have an airport where I can land? I told him, well, we don't have an airport, we don't have any gateway, and so on. And the question becomes for any multinational or any private sector investor, if you can't go in and out of a country, why would you invest? This is why the political track is extremely important. Yes, it's ambitious. As a matter of fact, they call it aspirational plan. But I think there are a lot of areas where we can work on under the present circumstances. and with some relaxation on the Israeli side.
Thank you for this language of enablers and aspirational. I hadn't realized they were
I'm quoting that from the
plan. I've got a number of people asking about the water situation in Palestine. Can any of you address this at this point?
The water situation is really pretty catastrophic. I mean, it is one of the enablers, for example, on the agriculture. The first thing we need to do is to rehabilitate all our wells. And, you know, from a point of view, when you look at the aquifers, we will have what the horizontal siphoning of the water into Israel, and I think the situation is extremely dire and needs to be addressed. And I think one of the things Secretary Kerry was able to achieve is to increase the water quota into the West Bank, which impacts enormously because one of the sectors which they're focusing on is the agri sector. And also, you need to know that we do have a problem also in one of the enablers we need is to get fertilizers in.
Mr. Sedam, you wanted to add something here. We got quickly, please, if you could.
Sure. I just want to mention that 75% of the water reservoir is under the settlements. So settlements are really filtering out Palestinian water and are leaving a Palestinian with 1 liter vis-a-vis 8 liters per Israeli settler, which shows the reality and the grim reality that we Palestinians face. Some localities spend 6 months without water, spend the time and money buying water tanks in order to feed their systems.
Gentlemen, I appreciate very much your being with us. Let's hope there is some movement forward for some kind of political economic settlement as well. And again, all four of the gentlemen who are with us will be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club, Market Street, at 6 p.m. A correction from the last hour, Diane Ravitch will speak tonight at Stanford's Memorial Auditorium at 5:15, not at 6 o'clock, as previously mentioned. I want to again thank Amira Carr and Nafez Husseini, Sabir Sidem, and Zahi Khoury. And thank you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, and our engineer, Danny Bringer. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.